The Monologue.
Well, today on this Monday, we have a new COVID policy in place, a new mandate coming from a governor who doesn't want to give up any control, any power whatsoever, because he comes from a party that either largely agrees with him or the members of the party don't have enough clout to call them out, the ones who are actually upset with the direction that this governor has taken us. It is yet another mandate that is not based at all in science or the data that we have available, but it is based in this effort to try to get as many people vaccinated as possible, and now that includes your kids. The mandate now is for large events. It applies to everyone over the age of 12 years old. If you're going to an outdoor event with 10,000 or more people in attendance, or you're going to an indoor venue with 1,000 people or more, you now have to show proof of vaccine or a negative COVID test within the last 3 days of the event. Now, they're doing this because they want to pressure more people into getting a vaccine by making life more difficult for the unvaccinated. They don't necessarily care if you're vaccinated and don't like these kinds of policies and you view them as government overreach. They don't care about that. Their end goal is as many shots in arms as possible, regardless of the consequences. And yes, there are consequences to getting a vaccine when you don't need one or shouldn't get one, according to your doctor. But they don't care what your individual doctor says. They want you to listen to some doctor you've never met and who's never met you, because they believe that the risk is small enough that if it impacts one person or two people or 10 people, it in the end is worth it. Now, from a public health standpoint, I certainly understand that. I actually agree with that, that when you come up with any sort of policies, there's always going to be some small consequence that you hope is not that big of an issue for enough people that it prevents them from getting going along with the policy. I get that. Purely understand that from a purely sort of policy standpoint. However, as an individual, you should be a lot more aware of risks. For example, if you are a 16-year-old boy, do you absolutely need this vaccine? I don't think the data suggests that you absolutely need it. Doesn't mean you shouldn't get it. Doesn't mean you shouldn't want it. But there are certainly some unintended consequences and risks associated with this, particularly of young boys who end up getting the vaccine. They have seen an increased chance of getting something called myocarditis. We've talked about it in the past. This is basically the swelling or inflammation of the heart. Now, it's not risky to the individual. It's not going to cause death unless, of course, you just don't treat it. And rather than have honest conversations about the risks associated with the vaccine and young people in particular, the folks over in Olympia, as well as in D.C., are pretending that there are no risks whatsoever, which I think is dangerous. I think that's deadly. I don't think that the actual COVID vaccine is deadly for the vast majority of people. I think by ignoring legitimate side effects, telling them that they don't exist or downplaying them so that when a kid ends up experiencing them, that kid ends up saying, oh, well, it can't be that big of a deal. I would have learned about it, heard about it. I think that that is deadly and wrong. It's wrong. But again, lots of people are moving forward with this. People in Washington State especially love these new policies. They will never get people in this state to push back against them, which is why Inslee is so brazen with his overstepping of authority.
It can help incentivize people to decide to get vaccinated and avoid the headache of having to get a test.
Yeah, exactly. He's acknowledging the reason why they're doing this is to make life harder, coerce you. They're trying to coerce you, and they're using your comfort level against you, pushing kids who may not need it or want it into getting a vaccine so that they can go to a concert they've been dying to go to after being basically told they can't have a life for the last year. Scott Smith is a new father. He lives in Olympia. He supports the new policies. He spoke with Q13.
I've known a lot of people who have been affected by COVID. A couple of people who have passed away from it. A lot of my friends would actually probably disagree with me on this, but no, it's affected our community enough to the point where I think anything that we can do to get ourselves out of this situation, we need to.
Except what if it doesn't get us out of the situation? Because when we got vaccinated the first time around and they told us if we hit 70%, we wouldn't need to wear a mask. But then they said, noops, never mind. So they've set a new goal. They set a new standard, only I'm assuming to eventually ignore that one. Then what? Then what does Scott say? At what point does Scott step back and say, okay, you know what? I've gone pretty far with y'all. I've trusted you. And you keep going back on your word. So at what point will people start saying, okay, enough is enough? And clearly in the state of Washington, we're not there yet. And that's an unfortunate reality. Not because I'm an anti-vaxxer. I'm pro-vaccine. I want people to get vaccinated in consultation with their doctor. But I also want to make sure that we're not giving this government so much power that we're going to regret it in the end. And I think we're already at that point. In fact, I know we're at that point.
The interview.
It truly is never too early to lean into all that we love about the holiday season. And for those of you who are curious as to some of your favorite Fox News personalities, what they did growing up for Christmas and what they still do for Christmas, their traditions, you can check it out in a brand new book. It's out tomorrow. It's called All American Christmas. The co-authors, Rachel Campos Duffy and Sean Duffy, both Fox News contributors, join me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having us on.
I'm kind of weird in that as a Jew, I obviously did not celebrate Christmas, and yet I love Christmas music. And anything that kind of gets into the holiday season, I just jump at. So, Rachel, we'll start with you. How did you go about collecting all of these traditions? Because I imagine that they were overwhelming.
So first of all, I have a chapter just for you because we actually have, well, kind of. We have Geraldo Rivera, who grew up in a Jewish and Catholic household. And the chapter is amazing because you really get a sense of there was a lot of tension in how they were going to work out the Christmas Jewish tradition, you know, how was it going to all play out? And his mom was very traditional and did not Jewish and did not want anything Christian going on. And it appears like at some point his dad became sort of more Catholic. So there was tension. And then Geraldo kind of discusses how he loved Christmas and kind of didn't really like the way his mom was doing stuff. So he had to beg for a tree. And there were all these different compromises that happened in the family. And so they ended up calling it Christmaka, and sort of you get this chapter of how different families come together and have to work out the holidays. And even Sean and I, even though we're both Catholic, we're both different, right? So I have Hispanic traditions, and he had a lot of Irish Catholic traditions, and some overlapped, but some weren't. And so we compromised and had to work out which ones we kept and which ones we left behind. We left behind mincemeat pie, Jason, for the record. we decided not to follow through with that one, but we picked up new ones. And one of the things, because Sean is from Wisconsin, is I grew up as a military brat, and as the daughter of a man from Arizona, I grew up with fake Christmas trees. And, of course, that would be like sacrilegious in the Duffy North Woods of Wisconsin, right? And so I really grew to love the idea that we go into the woods and we get our own Christmas tree and cut it down ourselves and put it in our house. And so that's sort of the essence of the book. But if you know anyone who loves Fox News or listens to Fox News, mom, dad, grandpa, grandma, brother, sister, this is like the easiest Christmas gift you can get because just buy the book and
Yeah, and it's out tomorrow. Again, it's called All American Christmas. And what's always so interesting about these kinds of books, Sean, is that, you know, you've got a lot of people and you presume that you're going to get a lot of the same stories. And yet, even doing some of the more traditional things, like Maria Bartiromo talks about how, you know, she was known for her light displays in the neighborhood. But then you also get stories like from Lawrence Jones, who talks about, you know, it's not always just about the idea of getting gifts, but it's about giving back.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's why I think this book is so cool, is because so many people see the talent on Fox and get to know them very personally for the hour, sometimes 3 hours they spend with that talent, you know, throughout the day. And this is a very different way of getting to know people because, you know, we have so many of the Fox talent that are sharing their very personal stories about growing up, how they celebrated Christmas and actually how they do it today and how they melded tradition. But I some of my favorite stories, and it's funny because Jesse Waters talks about the Christmas that they went out and bought a, or they cut down a Christmas tree And he tells the story of the big fight that took place with the squirrel and the cat as they came upon Christmas. And I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but if you get the book and you read it, you will laugh your pants off.
Let's just say the squirrel was illegal.
Uh-oh.
Jason, one last point I want to make. There's no supply chain issues. This book is not stuck in some tanker off the coast of California because it was American produced, American made. So you can get it at your store tomorrow, whether it's Barnes & Noble, wherever you shop. You can go to foxnewsbooks.com and grab it there. Again, this makes the perfect gift. And again, great stories for Fox fans.
And we're climbing up the chart, Jason. We're like number 5 right now on the Amazon bestseller list.
Love
we can
it.
Make it number 1. And we can make Christmas great again. And we'll make Hanukkah great again, too.
There
Jason.
We go. I love that.
And contributorship great again as well.
Yeah, I'm definitely weighing in on that.
I love it. Well, I'll be pushing folks right now. Go to Amazon.com, purchase the book so we can get it to number 1. And then, of course, make sure you can also go to foxnewsbooks.com for direct access. Again, the name of the book is All American Christmas. Thank you guys so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jason. We love you. Take care.
Thank you.
The monologue.
Unfortunately, inflation is going to be with us for a while. It's not the transitory blip that the Biden administration promised it was. And it's having impacts on folks in ways you might not immediately think of. We always think about it on the personal first. That's normal. That's human nature. That when the price of goods go up, you look at your own grocery bill and you say, oh my gosh, I'm spending way more now than I did last time. Now, obviously, inflation doesn't just hit food. We talked a little bit about it earlier on in the show. Veterinary bills, for example, are up some 25% or so. It impacts pretty much everything across the board. Now, depending on where you live, you'll get hit more or you'll get hit less or you won't get hit at all. Again, it depends on where you are. And again, I said this earlier. Eggs and milk in the Seattle area are actually lower than it was a year ago. A lot of this has to do with local economies, local agriculture, the supply chain issues and how it impacts someone in a city further away from a port than not. There's all these things that go into it. But overall, when you look at where things are, inflation has gone up some 6%+ across the board. And grocery prices continue to rise. And not only does that mean for those of you who have to go food shopping for a large family, not only does it mean you have to be spending more money on that, but also more money on Thanksgiving coming up next week, people who are already struggling end up going to food banks. And those food banks are also struggling. You see, a lot of that food is donated. You get perhaps less donations when prices go up. Sometimes where there's the need, but not necessarily the supply being donated, you have food banks going out and purchasing it from businesses, purchasing what it is they need. So, for example, if they're doing something around Thanksgiving, they know people might want yams. If for some reason they're not getting canned yams, okay, they go out to the Safeway and they end up buying a bunch. And it's concerning to them because they have limited resources, they have limited funding. And now they have to figure out how they're going to get by. Christina Wong is the director of the public policy and advocacy over at the Puget Sound Labor Agency. And she's talking big picture first, but she speaks to King 5 about how some are being forced to be a little bit more thrifty than they otherwise would be and having to choose some essentials over others.
We know that these households are being thrifty and making the decisions that are right for their households. But what it means is that they are having to choose between food and other essentials, choices that none of us would ever want to have to make.
And that means when we're picking and choosing between essentials, it's still an essential. So people end up going to places like the Northwest Harvest. And they said that they're seeing an increase in people seeking assistance, which again makes sense given the information, given that 6.2% inflation is real and it hurts. No matter what people like Stephanie Ruhle of MSNBC tell you. Jacob McKay is the operations and grants manager over at Puget Sound Labor Agency and says they're going to do whatever they can, but they're also stretched really thin.
If we need to go out and buy turkeys and buy stuffing, I think we're going to do it. It's just going to be stretched thin, you know?
They run a bunch of food banks in the area. One recently moved to the Georgetown neighborhood, and like so many other food banks, they rely heavy on donations. but they've said they noticed a steep drop off in things being given to them. Some of the stuff, the staples that are more expensive, staples like oatmeal and rice. They say they're planning to start buying more proteins. You heard some of what they would buy. Unfortunately, this is not going to end anytime soon. We don't think it is. I know that the Biden administration is spinning to the point where they're so dizzy they fall over about how, oh, no, don't worry, this is going to be fine. We're doing so much to help. What are you doing? What is the Biden administration doing to help this situation, to make it better? They won't even acknowledge that they got it wrong. Everyone else said months ago that inflation was real and it's happening and it's going to hurt. And they downplayed it. They pretended it wasn't happening. And then they were like, oh, well, it's kind of happening, but don't worry. It's not that big of a deal. It's going to go away soon. Whereas everybody else was saying, no, that's not true. The only people who agreed with that were the Biden sycophants over at CNN and MSNBC. And rather than tell us what they're doing to make this better, they're just saying, oh, we're doing something. Trust us. Well, you don't really have a good track record deserving of trust.
The interview.
Some good news for parents who actually want to make sure that quality content gets in front of their kids. There's a new children's book series coming out. It's an illustrated children's book series that focuses on what they're calling heroes of liberty. Ronald Reagan, Amy Coney Barrett, Thomas Sowell, folks that your kids should absolutely know about, but you can't really trust. Some people will tell their stories accurately. Joining me on the line is the editor of the Heroes of Liberty series. She's also a board member. Her name is Bethany Mandel. Bethany, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So this is obviously really cool news, and we're seeing a trend going in this direction. Dan Crenshaw was on the show not too long ago, also talking about books for children. It's one of those industries we've sort of ceded to the left.
Yes, I mean, this is an issue that I've sort of focused on a lot in my professional writing, and that's why I was so interested when the Heroes of Liberty folks came to me and said they were working on this project, because speaking to a lot of people who work in the children's book industry, and it's one of the librarians who I spoke to called it a tidal wave of woke. In every sort of arena of children's literature, it's becoming woke. And so some of the titles that you'll see in Barnes & Noble and in your kids' school libraries and in your public libraries are Swish, 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 Go the Drag Queen Tips, and Race Cars, a book about white privilege. There's a children's biography of RuPaul, and then there's, I think the count is 27 children's books about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and exactly zero books about Amy Coney Barrett. So we sort of saw a hole in the market and wanted to fill it with really quality, well-illustrated, well-written children's literature about figures that the publishing houses in New York won't touch.
Exactly. I think that's the big key. It's not so much that we have to wait a little bit longer for an Amy Coney Barrett book. Like, I get that she's newly installed on the court. No one's going to pick it up unless a conservative does so. And, you know, part of the series, it's you're not talking conservative politics. You're just talking about conservative values that used to be seen as just traditional American values.
Yes, 100%. And so, like, the Amy Coney Barrett book, for example, I think the biggest lesson that you take from it, there's very little mention of politics and of sort of her judicial perspective one way or the other, which I think a lot of people don't love, both on the right and the left, but we don't touch it. What we touch on is her motherhood. That's really sort of the focal point of that book, that she is so successful and so accomplished while at the same time a mother. And this is the kind of messaging that especially girls are not getting now. They're not getting the message that you can do it all and that it all includes motherhood. So we have five children, and I've been looking around for books about large families, and anything written in the last 15 years, large families are just a punchline. They're not actually the focal point of any children's literature anymore. And so that's another really wonderful thing about the Amy Coney Barrett book, is that it really highlights in a positive way the fact that she's a mother of a large family.
Exactly. So the series is out right now. The first three are out right now. It's called the Heroes of Liberty series, and it's on Thomas Sowell, Amy Coney Barrett, and Ronald Reagan. You've got several other books on deck to come out shortly. Is there any guarantee that they'll actually see the light of day in these woke bookstores?
I don't know. So as of now, we're not on Amazon. So the only place you can get our books is on heroesofliberty.com. Will these libraries stock them? I mean, we heard from one school librarian in Iowa that she wanted to, But, you know, we'll see. I don't know. That's the big question mark.
Yeah, and you know what? If people actually show that there is a demand, well, guess what? They will eventually be stocked. You might have to put a little bit more pressure on folks than you otherwise would.
Yeah.
But it's a good cause. I think everyone right now should go to heroesofliberty.com, purchase the three books that are out right now for your kids. What's the age range that you're going for?
So I think the best ages are between 6 and 12. And, you know, for the younger ages, you read to them, and the older ages, they get read to. And there's a lot to be said for that.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think the 6 to 12 is a good range.
There you go. Go to heroesofliberty.com. Order your books today. In fact, you get the three of them for $45, which is a really good deal. Go to heroesofliberty.com, or I guess you can let your kids continue to read books about why they're all racist. And if they want to get into the world of drag queens, don't do anything. But if you're concerned about the messages being pushed in some of these woke books, go to heroesofliberty.com. We've been talking with the editor, Bethany Mandel. Bethany, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Again, the website, heroesofliberty.com. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.
The Jason Rand Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rantz.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rantz, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
In a lot of ways, my next guest did not get a fair chance at running the Seattle Police Department, a city that she was doing really, really well for, until all of a sudden the council decided to use the death of George Floyd and pretend that the SPD was somehow the problem. In the rise of the defund movement, you had council members who chose politics over public safety. And in the end, they pushed Carmen Best out of her position as police chief. They won't, of course, say it that way, but that's what happened. She's now back in the news because she got a brand new book out. It's called Black and Blue: Lessons on Leadership, Breaking Barriers, and Racial Reconciliation. And she joins me now. Chief Best, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I like the title of the book because in a lot of ways, the way that I was framing it when I was talking about it on Fox, what happened to you, and this all happened around the time of Chop and Chaz, was that we are so inclusive and so woke in Seattle that we push out the city's first Black female police chief. And it's a weird sort of mix in a city that's this progressive.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it was. I do believe that Seattleites really are a very, by nature, very inclusive community and want to do the right thing. But in this case, you know, the politics, as you said, outweighed the real need and performance that we were trying to achieve at the police department. So politics really set the course of the day under these circumstances.
Now, a lot of the book is based on the lessons you learned on how to become a leader, what, you know, makes a good leader. What did you learn from your just the last month and a half, 2 months of your tenure that you're now taking wherever it is you end up going?
Yeah, well, you know, the book, as you said, Leadership Lessons, talks about things I've learned really throughout my life. And certainly one of the key things is that all those lessons throughout life that we learn, I felt like they all came into play as we were working through some of the most confrontational times that we'd had in the police department, and certainly that I'd experienced as a police chief. So, you know, just learning how to utilize mentors and sponsors and allies, you know, how to be resilient, how to stick by your convictions and what that means. And in the face of even the most challenging times, you have to be true to yourself, even if that means that you may have to walk away from a position at the end of the day.
Well, I think that part is really important. You stuck by your convictions. You could have stayed, right? I mean, they didn't fire you. You made the choice to leave because of, frankly, how you were treated, how your officers were treated. And in a lot of ways, the symbolism of what it meant for you to leave, right? I believe part of why you left was to send the message that what was going on was not okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk about that in Black and Blue, the issues that we were facing, all of the, you know, the rhetoric, political rhetoric that was out there. And it was really hurting the cops, quite frankly, and honestly, with hurting the community as a whole, because you have to have a public safety plan. It just can't be camp run amok and we expect things to be okay. And I never saw that plan come forward. I still have not seen that plan come forward. And so it was, you know, a way for me to really highlight, you know, the fact of what we were doing. And also, and again, I talked about this in Black and Blue, it was also a situation where it was setting up the police chief for failure. How can you effectively run a department if you defund it and get rid of over 100 officers out of the agency without a backup plan?
Exactly. And to your point, there still is no real safety plan in the work. And I don't blame the interim chief and Adrian Diaz for that. I definitely blame the mayor, even though politically she's a lame duck at this point, but it's the council that's gotten in the way. And, you know, you talk about in the book Black and Blue how you developed something called situational leadership. We're all aware of what situational awareness is. You're basically saying we take that same exact concept, but we sort of tailor how we lead when things are rapidly changing around you. Were you able to effectively do that in the world of politics?
Yeah, well, you know, you have to change to a certain degree what you can change to make things work, to evolve as situations evolve. And certainly I think I tried to do that, and I do delineate that in the book. That said, there's only so much you can do reasonably and still be effective. And so and that was the most critical piece, is being effective, you know, making sure that we were able to provide a high level of public safety under the circumstances. So when those initial cuts were coming through the budget, we were really working frantically to figure out how to move forward and comply with those cuts. But once they became, you know, this mantra of 50% or over 100 officers, you know, that's not a realistic way to run an organization and to provide public safety. And ultimately, it was completely predictable, as we have now, the uptick in crime, and there would not be the ability to address it, right? Because there wouldn't be the officers there. And so here we are, you know, totally predictable that we would have these increases. Now we have less people that are able to respond to those calls for service. And so I think Chief Diaz is doing, you know, a good job under the circumstances. But this, again, was completely predictable.
We're talking with former Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best. The name of her book is Black and Blue. It's out right now. I highly recommend you check it out. I have it ready for my trip on Wednesday. I'm taking a rather lengthy plane ride, so I'll be diving in more depth than what I've already done. But you talk early on in the book about the importance of relationships. It's so important to have really good relationships with other leaders, people who report to you, people who are, you know, your colleagues, because that's an effective way of leading. They have to like you. They have to trust you. When you look back at what happened in Seattle, especially with the council, how much of this was due to relationships versus that sort of that the outlier influence, the external influence of activists in the community?
Yeah, you know, Jason, I think relationships are everything. And anybody who's worked with me or around me has heard me say that. You know, we have to build relationships. We have to find common ground. We have to move forward in a way that everyone's opinion and everyone's thoughts are at least taken into account and considered. And so relationships are critically important, as you said and as I wrote in my book. The situation with the city council, I think, was a situation where at one point we did have relationships, but, you know, at some point they really weren't communicating with me effectively for the most part. And so the relationship was broken. And how do you move forward if you're not having a conversation and communicating with all the stakeholders? You simply cannot. If you are pandering to, you know, a smaller segment of society, a smaller group, you're not really taking in the interests of everyone as a whole. And I think as elected officials and as police chiefs or whomever, you really need to do that.
You've said that if it was up to you, if it was purely up to you, you would have not abandoned the East Precinct, which then gave way to the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, which gave way to two black boys being murdered there. And the lawlessness that ensued every single day outside of that was obviously incredibly serious. Do you think that Mayor Jenny Durkan was a good leader, or should she purchase Black and Blue and learn some lessons on leadership?
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to criticize the mayor. Look, we were in an incredibly, you know, unprecedented time. I mean, where else in history have we had a pandemic, you know, a huge social reckoning, days of protests, you know, night after night after night, and just this, you know, sort of atmosphere that was incredibly, you know, incredibly tumultuous and completely unpredictable. So, you know, I don't want to criticize any part. I think everyone was trying to do the best they could under the circumstances. You know, clearly, you know, my goal was we were out of the precinct and this completely unprecedented CHAZ, then CHOP appeared, you know, was only to get us back into the precinct and to do so safely so we could provide public safety. And as you know, while the CHAZ was allowed, the CHAZ and the CHOP lingered, you know, it became incredibly lawless on a number of fronts until we were able to clear it out. So I really want to refrain from, you know, pointing fingers at anybody, you know, too much here, because I do recognize the volatility of the situation. And everybody was trying to balance a First Amendment free speech along with public safety. I had a vested interest as a police chief in seeing officers and cops back in the building. I don't know that everybody had the same sense of urgency that I did, but I also recognize the unprecedented nature of what we were dealing with.
Yeah, well, I think we both agree that history will show over and over and over again that it was the wrong move to abandon the precinct, given what ended up happening. And you called it out at the time. I mean, you were upfront about what you thought was going to happen after that decision.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, the moving out of the precinct, the evacuation of the precinct really was, you know, the decision to do that, while, you know, I wish we had more conversation about it, I do think it was public safety and the safety interests of the officers and the people on board that really contributed to that, to the decision to evacuate. No one could have foreseen, you know, these folks coming in and taking over the neighborhood in the fashion that they did. The sense of urgency was, though, to mitigate that and to stop it, in my view, sooner rather than later, because as it lingered, it became more and more, you know, more violent as time went on.
Folks can obviously get a bigger look behind the scenes of what went into that by purchasing Black and Blue. It's out right now. You can buy it wherever it is you purchase your books. Before we let you go, about a month and 2 weeks ago or so, you and I had a conversation about a rumor that I had heard that you were up for the job for the next police chief in New York City. There's a new mayor who's a former cop himself, and Eric Adams. This is someone who actually respects police officers. Democrat, but on policing, I'll probably agree with him 9 out of 10 times. At the time, you told me that there were no meetings that you had with anyone in New York where you happened to have been at the time that the rumor started. Was that accurate?
It was true, Jason. It's funny. I don't know if you're clairvoyant or what, but it was absolutely true. I had gone to New York for a cybercrimes conference and was there to talk about some of those issues and how we were dealing with some of those issues in Seattle. And that was really the gist of the meeting at that point. You know, subsequent to that, you know, I have been, you know, reached out to as one of the potential candidates for the commissioner's position. You know, and I feel very honored and very flattered that, you know, that I'm being considered, you know, in this role. So we'll see where it lands, but it's very early on.
Is it safe to say you want the job? If you were offered, you would take it?
Yeah, well, it's New York. I you know, obviously there's a lot of things that would have to be discussed and talked about, but certainly I think it's a real honor to be considered, and if they ask me to throw my hat in the ring, I'm going to do it.
Well, there you go. Well, as I said at the time, I was sorry to see you go from your position in Seattle. I understood the position that you ended up taking. I think it was the right one for you and certainly sent the message that need to be sent. Before we let you go, do you think that this council specifically has learned its lessons? It certainly doesn't seem that way.
You know, only time will tell what's happening, what's going to happen. My understanding was there's still some calls to further cut the policing budget. I don't think that's the right way to go and the right decision. And honestly, Jason, you know, I talk about this in Black and Blue. It's not either or. I mean, we can enhance public safety and incorporate a lot of different alternatives to help with public safety, but it has to be a plan. You know, you still have to have cops. You know, you're not safer without police officers. You're just not. So I think that is, we'll see what council comes up with. So far, though, I think it's, you know, questionable.
There you go. The name of the book, it's out right now. It's called Black and Blue, Lessons on Leadership, Breaking Barriers, and Racial Reconciliation. Carmen Best, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. Take care.
Absolutely.
The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rance, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
I want to play for you the segment. It's short, but the segment I did on Tucker Carlson on Friday. I broke a story there. We broke it here first, but as you know, I don't like breaking big stories on Fridays because I think that there's a tendency for a lot of you guys, it's no fault of yours, but there's a tendency to sort of tune out any of the serious stuff as you're going into a weekend. But it's serious enough that I wanted to do a quick refresher on what that story is all about because people's lives are on the line and it's worth paying attention to. So here's my segment on Tucker Carlson tonight.
The Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans has just affirmed its decision to stop Joe Biden's lunatic vax mandate for businesses that have more than 100 employees. The Biden administration has signaled that it will just ignore it. Now, the mandate isn't working. It's unconstitutional. More Americans have died of COVID under Biden than under the previous president, Donald Trump. So in no way does anyone benefit, but a lot of people are being hurt. In fact, all of us. These mandates have led to a shortage of first responders in major cities. In Seattle, for example, those shortages have deadly consequences. Jason Rance has followed that in detail. He's a radio host in Seattle. He broke this story. He joins us now. Jason, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Tucker. We have a story of a 13-year-old boy who ended up watching helplessly as his 45-year-old father was struggling to breathe in the North Seattle apartment. And due to the vaccine mandate crippling our police and fire departments, there was a significant delay in response. Now, this happened last Tuesday afternoon. The boy called 911 to report his father was having some kind of medical emergency, and the dispatcher sent out an alert. Unfortunately, Seattle Fire was down a medical unit that day because of the staffing crisis, but still they were able to send an aid unit to firefighters who actually arrived within minutes. However, when they actually got there, they were told not to go inside because this address was flagged in their system as having a resident known to be combative with police and fire. So they had to wait for police to arrive before they actually were able to go in. But this SPD is dramatically understaffed because of this vaccine mandate where Mayor Jenny Durkan pushes out 100 officers or so due to it. And I can tell you, it took 8 minutes for an officer to even be assigned to this case. And as this was going on, this poor kid ends up having to call 911 a second time. Take a listen.
Look at his chest and tell me if it's rising and falling.
Barely.
Okay, is it
almost
moving?
Not at all.
So almost not at all or not at all?
Almost not at all. Almost.
So unfortunately, police were not able to get there as quickly as the firefighters would like. They went in anyway. Unfortunately, they pronounced this father dead after working on him for an hour. And the tragic irony here is that alert, that flag on the address, was incorrect. It was meant for a different person who lived in that apartment. And if the officers were able to get there a little bit sooner, this might have ended differently. Tucker?
Ah, I just feel sick hearing that. Jason Rance, thank you for your reporting on that.
Now, the full video is up right now at youtube.com/Jason Rance.
The Last Rance.
And with that, I have a favor to ask. I will use that time of my last rants to ask a favor. I need more eyes on this story. I need more ears on this story. I think that this is an issue that people have to be very well aware of. And so I need you to not just read it or watch the video yourself, but I need you to amplify it. That means I need you to pass it around. Now, thankfully, this is a story that's already been picked up by the New York Post and the Daily Mail. Lots of national and international outlets picked it up. No one locally. No one locally. Como didn't pick it up. King didn't pick it up. They're the worst. Q13 didn't pick it up. Cairo didn't pick it up. Seattle Times definitely not going to pick it up. And even if any of them did, they would do a poor job anyway. They'd leave a whole bunch of details out or they'd pretend that it's not true. But we know it's true. And so I need you to help me do the work to publicize it because people have to put pressure on this council, on this mayor to change the situation. So please text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. And I'll send you a link to my show blog where you can just click the link. It's the second story. Post it on your Twitter feed and Facebook and LinkedIn account. Post it anywhere you can. When you text RANTZ to 1-800-465-8770, I'll also send you a direct link to my YouTube channel or my Twitter feed, my Facebook profile. Go wherever it is you normally go so you can get the content and then share it. We need more eyes on this story. People's lives are on the line. That's the last rant.